Nexus PMG welcomes you to the Bigger Than Us podcast, which we as energy geeks lovingly refer to as the BTU. Bigger Than Us is a podcast that focuses on ideas that will shape the future of our planet and ultimately our existence. We will occasionally lean into energy topics because, after all, it's the key to our collective survival, but we'll also explore other ideas and topics that we believe will have an impact that is bigger than us. And now, on to today's show. Before we get to the show, just a quick thank you for your continued support. In the last few months, we've ranked number 8 in Spain, number 9 in Australia, number 3 in Denmark, number 2 in Portugal, number 1 in Israel, number 10 in Australia, number 9 in Greece, number 4 in Vietnam, number 9 in Great Britain, number 8 in Singapore, number 1 in Saudi Arabia, and number 9 in India, specifically in the Apple Podcast Earth Sciences category. Thank you so much for all your support. We couldn't do it without you. And now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to the Bigger Than Us podcast. I'm your host, Raj Daniels, and today I'd like to welcome back to the show, Ben Hubbard. Ben Hubbard is the CEO of Nexus Holdings, a leading infrastructure advisory and project development organization dedicated to reducing carbon intensity and enhancing resource efficiency. His powerful ability to translate strategic organizational goals into clear operational plans has led to measurable results for the growing firm. Ben, how are you doing today?
Good, Raj. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while.
It has been a while, and we have a lot to catch up on. First of all, happy 11th anniversary. How does it feel to be around 11 years?
It feels good. You know, it's one of those things where every once in a while you got to take a step back and just kind of look from a bird's eye view and enjoy the milestones. And, you know, it's a big one. I think it's probably underappreciated how hard it is to have a business that survives 10 plus years these days. It's challenging, right? We went through COVID. We went through a lot of other things in between and rebrands and pivots. And so it's something we're very proud of as a management team.
You know, they say entrepreneurs age in dog years.
Yeah, I would say
four for every one human year.
Yeah, I was going to say I was definitely aged. We actually, at our 10-year anniversary party we had last year, we were sharing some photos with the gang and we had a photo that was a side-by-side of myself, Paul, and Roshan when we were founding the company in its early days versus one that was recently taken. And my, oh my, is it what entrepreneurship does to you. a lot of hair decline, a lot of color missing, you know, all that good stuff.
Well, the bright side is all three of you are still around and healthy to watch it grow.
That's it. You know, we have a lot of kids involved now and just lots of things have evolved and changed within the business, but also in our personal lives. It's fun to watch.
Well, speaking of things changing, let's go back 11 years, brief overview, initial idea, and then fast forward to where we are today. So take us back.
Yeah, it's kind of like a crash course for episode one. You know, obviously founded the company on the merits of kind of building an advisory practice, you know, set up shop in Dallas and began the journey that, you know, I've shared a few times and people are probably sick of me telling the story, but it was a lot of bumps and bruises. I would say, you know, since the last time we really spoke, right, we were coming kind of, it's crazy to think about, but we were coming out of COVID and, you know, trying to figure out how to navigate what that new landscape looked like. Everything from, I think people underappreciate like how it is for a small business to pivot from working from home and, you know, a whole new kind of generation of employee mindset relative to how work looks like, you know, a shrinking employee base because of just sheer job demand. So we were just kind of basically kind of rolling with the punches there and were able to, you know, to weather the storm, but also to really come through on the other side and be a part of this, what is, as you know, what the podcast dedicated to, just this absolute massive emergence of environmental oriented businesses, ESG in general, but specifically environmental, right, for reducing our carbon footprint. And so, you know, those who could weather the storm, I think, came out on the other side with just a massive inflection point in front of them. And so we've been focusing on really capitalizing on that inflection point we're seeing and what we think will be, you know, the base case for the next 10 plus years. And so we, you know, we'll talk about this in a minute, I'm sure, but we, you know, we raised some money around the fact that now is the time. And so that's kind of where the business stands today. We are fully capitalized and we've got a ton of strategic growth initiatives in front of us.
So let's talk about strategic versus opportunistic. This podcast has afforded me the opportunity to have 250 plus conversations that I've actually recorded. But for every one that I've recorded, I've had two or three quote unquote offline. And as I've been speaking to entrepreneurs on their journey, it's really interesting to see where they initially thought they would go versus where they end up or pursue forward. When you first started out and you made that hard pivot in 2019, was it opportunistic to move towards, I'm going to call clean tech broadly or environmentally conscious broadly, or was it strategic?
It was both. So I say that because we saw a massive business opportunity in large part because when you're an advisor to a lot of the private equity and infra funds, you get a really early glimpse of where things are trending, right? You get to see where money's flowing. You get to see what type of deal flow that people are getting excited about. And so, you know, we were able to evaluate, you know, the status of our advisory practice and see what the trends were that were shifting with the capital inflows. And then simultaneously, right, we were, you know, folks were having their own children and all sorts of life dynamics were changing as well to kind of be more focused and oriented around, you know, doing good and doing something that's impactful and being able to share a legacy with your children. It's personal motivations are different for everybody, but everybody had some common foundation of, you know, wanting to do more. And so I think when you merge those two things together back in, you know, the 2017, 2018 timeframe, we basically saw the opportunity to bring two worlds together, the desire to do something that you can truly, you know, look back on and be proud of, combined with the business opportunity and being kind of a first mover advantage by being ahead on the amount of experience in emerging asset classes that were focused on low carbon. So, you know, we were, you know, you never know, right? It was a big deal for us to give up kind of what we'll call our traditional, you know, client base, which was oil and gas and fossil fuels and mining and metals and things that we had done in our career, you know, for the first, you know, since graduating university. But, you know, it seemed like the right thing to do for a lot of reasons. And I think it's paid its dividends.
So fast forward, you mentioned the investment. It was a $50 million investment that came in mid last year, I believe was the announcement. What has that enabled you to do in this particular sector?
Yes, I think what we've seen is the raising of the capital essentially was designed to catalyze accelerated growth. We were already growing quite nicely. We, you know, we had a lot of great initiatives going on, and I'm pretty sure that had we not raised capital a year ago, or we would, you know, still be having this kind of nice, steady growth function, which, you know, for 10 years was essentially the focus of the business. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's one of the reasons why I think we were around for 10 plus years is that we were slow and steady and just, you know, consistently growing and not getting above our ski tips. And I think that mentality still remains today, but there was an obvious inflection point opportunity to kind of catalyze some key areas of growth and not necessarily go wider, but just go deeper into the things we were doing. And so, you know, for a couple of years prior to raising, we had been incubating some of our own development platforms around RNG and SAF and some of the sectors that we know really well. And just kind of dipping our toe in the water to see if it's something that we could really, you know, drive growth in our business from. And we, you know, we've been supporting lots of other developers. We design other people's facilities through our front engineering design practice. You know, we have a turnaround practice that does a lot of work for fixing things that are broken and getting getting steady state operations for difficult assets. And so we saw, you know, this time to kind of expand our footprint. And so, but it's expensive, right? It's very difficult to incubate large scale infrastructure development companies, you know, like software industry and things of that nature for a relatively low cost. You can figure out if you can hit magnitudes of scale in a decent short order time, but in infrastructure, you need a lot of money and a lot of patience, a lot of time. And so, you know, we had the unique opportunity to offer what I'll call downside risk protection to investors by saying, look, we've got an operating asset up in Canada that's doing really well, and we have a services business that makes really, really healthy margins and is growing. And so we could essentially figure out how to utilize that kind of what we'll call collateral to basically attract capital that would allow us to flow money into our development companies, into some of our distress strategy, and some of the things that we felt were, you know, they're not easy things to do, high risk, high reward, but things that we felt we were really good at and that we could differentiate ourselves from the market doing. And so we kind of combined that mentality, and we were successful in attracting capital from, you know, Greenbacker Development Corporation with co-invest from Liberty Mutual and Ontario Power Generation's pension fund, which was awesome. Great partners to have. Really thrilled about, you know, the partnership that we have. And we've been essentially, you know, flowing money down into those aspects of the business I just noted. And now that it's been a year, we're seeing tremendous traction, and that capital has essentially allowed those businesses to evolve so much faster than they would have had we not done the deal.
Now, the company structure has changed. Can you lay out what the new lines, the business lines look like?
Yeah. So as we, when we closed the round, you know, historically for myself, for example, I was the CEO of the company, but which was largely for many years, the services business. And the services business is quite sizable now and has lots of employees and requires, you know, full attention. And so as part of that capital raise, we essentially, you know, birthed MPMG Holdings or Nexus Holdings, which essentially will hold the interest of the many things that we do. And so I have moved up to kind of run the holding company, which is, you know, kind of trying to pretend to be a conductor of a, you know, of a wide range of a wide range of businesses. And then we brought in a gentleman by the name of Ross Ferranzo, who is now running the services company, who's got a very deep, rich history in the energy sector and was a candidate and person who we thought very highly of and is already off to a fantastic start running that business and growing it. And so as part of that, we essentially now have seven portfolio companies that sit under the holding company, of which the services business is one of them. You know, our holdings and our asset up in Canada, we have our development companies, amongst other things that essentially we govern at the top. And then I kind of sit as a liaison to orchestrate the interconnection points between all of them and protect the business accordingly, as well as serve as the, you know, kind of governance liaison up to our board and our investors. And so it's been a, you know, a bit of a change in role for me, but one that I've really embraced. And I find that, you know, there's a lot of unique challenges in learning some of these skill sets, and I've enjoyed it.
So you mentioned 2017-18 timeframe, working with the investor community, being able to see where perhaps the capital was flowing, or put another way, look around the corner. If you were to say today, 2024, where is the capital flowing and what corners are you looking around?
Yeah, so we're very bullish on the sustainable aviation fuel industry. When you just look at that industry, it is the vast, vast, vast majority of the emissions in the airline industry come from fuel. I mean, it shadows anything even remotely close to it underneath it. And so the only real way the airline industry can decarbonize is to start producing sustainable aviation fuel at scale. We believe that ultra low carbon intensity sustainable aviation fuel is a critical focal point. And that is to say, you know, utilizing carbon sequestration and or carbon capture in some form or fashion to essentially create an aviation fuel that is extremely carbon negative, as opposed to like Jet A fossil, right? Or even traditional sustainable aviation fuel that doesn't have a sequestration back end. And the reason for that is when you just kind of do some basic math, you'll find that in order to decarbonize the airline industry, the fuel side on a traditional SAF basis without that sequestration, you would need thousands of sustainable aviation fuel refining facilities. And it's just not practical to think that we're going to be able to do that in a timeline that kind of is necessary, right? I mean, within reason. But when you look at like a ultra low CI based, you know, sustainable aviation fuel, you start making a more manageable growth trajectory that could actually have a material impact in a reasonable amount of time. And so we're very bullish on that. And that is something that we're, you know, putting capital behind, putting a lot of emphasis behind on the services side. We're designing several SAF facilities right now for our clients. There's just lots of great stuff going on there. We continue to be very bullish on the RNG sector. We think with the virtual pipelines and a lot of the stuff that's going on in, you know, in the need to transition various growing waste streams, such as everything from tires to food waste, you name it. and solving for what are, you know, filling landfills being maximized and full all over the country. And so we see this kind of waste transformation sector is continuing to explode in growth. Really, it just can only dig so many holes and you can, there's only so many outlets. And so the technologies are getting better and the economics are getting more refined. And so the RNG sector gets to benefit a lot from that waste transformation. It's a more mature sector than most relative to the commercial side. And so we're still very active in that space. And then we think there will inevitably be an emergence of the green hydrogen economy. I think it'll be a little bit slower than most probably want. I think carbon capture follows suit. But I do think there will be an inflection point in the next 5 to 7 years in particular, where you will see, you know, a pretty explosive growth in maybe hyper-localized and distributed assets and things within the sector, much like, you know, the oil and gas industry had a lot of compressor stations and liquefaction stations. I think people will be building these hydrogen fueling stations and virtual pipelines and all sorts of stuff over the years to come, especially with the Inflation Reduction Act's Treasury guidance recently being imposed. So it won't go as crazy as I think a lot of the early speculation was, but it's going to be a nice, solid growth story that plays a role. And so those are kind of three of the key areas, amongst others, that we're focused.
You mentioned a virtual pipeline. Can you define what that is?
Yeah. So funny enough, we have this is a little plug. We have a newsletter that our director of advisory services run calls the Energy Transition Insider. And as a matter of fact, today's issue was released from the desk. These newsletters are, each one is crafted by a specific subject matter expert within the Nexus ecosystem. And today's was actually on virtual pipelines for RNG from Ryan Patterson, who's one of the lead project managers for our waste to value platform. So I could get deep into it, but I kind of want to use this as an opportunity to force people to go check out the newsletter. So, but I'm happy to give a preview if you want.
Absolutely, preview. And then how can people subscribe to that newsletter?
Yeah, well, maybe we can share a link or something too in the footnotes when we post this. But so basically virtual pipelines are kind of slowly but surely disrupting, you know, traditional energy transportation infrastructure. Whereas with, you know, their physical counterparts, virtual pipelines are basically rely on a combination of kind of compressed natural gas. You'll often hear is referred to as CNG or liquefied natural gas, LNG, or other modular storage and transportation solutions to deliver those energy resources to some more remote and inaccessible areas. So you look at that rise of that solution mixed with renewable natural gas, and you really can see a lot of potential in those virtual pipelines. So, you know, for RNG, as most know that are probably listening to this or some that don't, but, you know, organic waste landfills, wastewater treatment plants, agricultural residues, et cetera, are the process path that produces RNG through various different technology types, the most predominant being anaerobic digestion right now. The sector is one that's notoriously relied on kind of carbon intensive gasoline and diesel. And so, we can massively make a big difference by reducing transport costs, and you can reduce your carbon intensity by reducing the amount of pipeline, you know, transportation you require for these things by leveraging more of a virtual approach where, you know, if California wants to buy gas, but we're making that gas in North Carolina, you can have that utility utilize like a swap with another utility, and then you essentially can, you know, utilize your local economy RNG and they can use it somewhere else in the country. But you have basically an economic model that will allow you to set the baseline on how that value of that gas will be purchased essentially. But it essentially is just kind of coming up with a more distributed infrastructure as opposed to having to just move, you know, fossil gas all over the place, which is historically what we've been doing.
It sounds very similar. And maybe it's just on my mind. I'm reading a book right now called The World for Sale, but it's about commodity traders and how perhaps oil is exchanged or traded amongst countries. So perhaps a tanker will leave one destination and not go to a second destination, but end up somewhere else. But oil will still get delivered to point B eventually. It sounds similar to that.
Yeah. I mean, if you had, you know, exactly. If you had the need to get RNG to a small town, small location in Georgia, but you're producing in North Carolina, but there's a producer that is a little bit closer. You could do something where he delivers to, you know, to the Georgia Light, and then you deliver and you guys solve each other's it's just a contract, essentially a sophisticated contract that allows you to do so. So it's, you know, and you've got things like compression units, mobile compression units, LNG trailers, you know, all sorts of things that allow you to kind of be more energy efficient.
So if I take a bird's eye view, like you mentioned earlier, everything seems like Nexus PMG up and to the right. But the reality is we all know that there have been challenges along the way. You mentioned COVID, distributed workforce. Specifically, when it comes to the environment right now with high interest rates, I've been reading about some challenges with projects in other areas. How has the current financial environment changed or perhaps tempered the push towards clean tech?
It's definitely tightened. It's tightened up. You know, people are generally, I would say, a lot of funds are focused on investing in their existing portfolio companies or putting some cash on the sidelines in order for any, you know, capital that's needed in anything they've already invested into to weather any storms or to, you know, for capital calls and things like that. So, yeah, it's definitely slowed down a bit. But that's all relatively speaking, right? There's still quite a bit of capital available for good projects and good assets that are ready to break ground. I think the biggest key to surviving and thriving, if you want to call it that, in these sectors is time and patience. I think a lot of people, a lot of companies, a lot of developers, they get unrealistic time-related expectations. And they build their businesses around that, their working capital requirements around that. And the reality is everything we do in these sectors and even in the types of work we do within the sectors just takes way longer, costs way more, and requires way more boots on the ground, hands-on approach than people want to give credit for. So I think if you're realistic and you set a realistic goal, realistic approach, and you build your business around that more realistic approach, you have a better chance of success. And I think that's what one of the things that we're really good at is we know things take longer, we know things cost more, and we just have a more realistic expectation up front to allow us to build around that knowledge. And, you know, a lot of these things, will be, you know, if we did another podcast, say 4 or 5 years from now, I think you'll find that the conversation will be vastly different because we'll be talking about, you know, how so-and-so has built 25 assets as opposed to how so-and-so is looking to build their first. And I think that's kind of where you're at. You're at this point where there's like first of a kind facilities. A lot of these emerging asset classes are kind of in facilities 1 and 2. There's a few people that are looking like they could get ahead of the curve and get their big, you know, showcase how it can work. And then in 5 years from now, there's going to be a lot of infra money, I think, pouring in to catalyze the growth because now you've got 2 assets running, making money. You can prove that it works. And now there's a ton of capital out there to go build assets 3 through 100, right? And I just think we're right there on the cusp of that type of capital being available to scale companies. We just need a few more years to kind of let the winners emerge, as I like to call it. Obviously, we would like to be a part of that formula. There's plenty of room for many, many to be successful, and we need everyone to be successful, or at least an anchor of them. And so I think that's kind of the state of affairs, if you want to call it that, and how Nexus kind of looks at the world and how we've built our business around that thesis.
Well, let's talk about how you look at the world. You know, entrepreneurs are perhaps painted with a broad brush of being notoriously impatient. How do you temper your patience?
Yeah, it's easier for some than others, to be very honest. So I have learned to be more patient over the years of growing this business with my partners, and my partner's the same. We aligned with our investors really well. They are patient capital. Obviously, this is all within reason, right? You can't sit around for years trying to find something to do, but but within reason, you know, we all aligned on the strategy. We all aligned on that. So I think when you have an investor base that you're really connected to at the hip, they believe in your strategy, they believe in your timeline, and they're not, you know, you didn't sign up and sell a false growth story that you can't meet because that's the only way to attract the capital. All that kind of stuff happens a lot, but we were able and fortunate to find investors and have a great partnership that really believes in that patience. And it's a lot easier to be patient when the catalytic growth capital behind you is understanding and is bought into that patient approach, right? And so you can sleep at night knowing that you don't have to wake up in the morning and say, like, we've done these 25 things, we have to move and make mistakes along the way, or just be sometimes being, you know, being, I'd rather be a little bit later to any of these parties than way too early. That's usually the death blow if you are. And so I think that that paradigm exists within our business, with our investors, and it's working out really well. It's really just kind of got a good cadence is probably the word I'll use right now.
So we're in election year. What, if any, murmurs are you hearing out there specifically regarding the outcome of the election, if it'll affect the business?
I'd be lying to you if I said that anyone, including myself, has a clue what's going to happen. I think politics in this country are unpredictable. And so, you know, we take our views, we have advisors that support us. We are ourselves sort of advisor, but you know, you do your best to try to take a view on what would happen based on, you know, historical norms, but you know, current political dynamics. But I think you could probably agree with me that there is so much uncertainty in those now that it's almost a wild guess, right? You try to insulate yourself. So things, for example, are how much dependency you take on subsidies that are really driven by a potential politically influencing, mm-hmm. you know, bill. I would say the Inflation Reduction Act is probably at the heart of that. And a lot of people are, you know, paying close attention to where things might shake out depending on the political landscape post-election. With that Inflation Reduction Act, you know, the Department of Energy through the Loan Program Office with Jigar Shah is exploding in growth and putting lots of capital to work. So, you know, I think I'd like to think that those things are leading to great jobs. They're leading to growth in tons of sectors. It's catalyzing new technologies. It's everything that mostly our political landscape on both sides likes to see. It's just a matter of, you know, does politics get in the way of itself and truly, you know, cause more harm than good just from because it's the right thing to do politically versus, you know, what I think is happening right now, which is just a lot of great growth across the board. So we'll see.
You mentioned ESG very early in the conversation. I read yesterday that BlackRock had to triple the security that they have on Larry Fink because of threats against him, specifically based on his comments on ESG. What, if any, conversations are you hearing or seeing? Because I know you well enough. You step outside your bubble quite a bit. What conversations are you hearing and seeing around ESG?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. There's a lot, and I don't know how much politics influences the mixed bag discussions, if I'm being honest, but generally speaking, you know, you've got a lot of different camps out there. You've got the camps that are extremely, let's move the needle forward now, yesterday sort of mentality. You've got a lot of folks that say, hold on a second, we got to get more real here. And, you know, it's a transition by definition, not a shift right overnight. So I think what you're seeing is just a convergence of people who are recognizing that this is harder and is going to take longer. And those people are battling the people that say, yeah, we don't have longer and we have to go faster. And you're just seeing a convergence of those two mindsets, I think, and trying to strike a balance on what is actually achievable and practical mixed with what do we need to do and giving ourselves the best chance of accomplishing our goals as a nation and as a planet, quite frankly. And I think I think the media potentially portrays it as unhealthy tension, but I actually think from my private conversations and in business dealings, find it to be tension that I think actually will yield a positive result because it will, it will allow us to move forward in a way that actually is something that we can get done, right? It doesn't make any sense. Just like I was talking about Nexus earlier, setting goals that are completely unachievable, just in the practical sense, it doesn't, you know, is good to an extent where it motivates and pushes people to work hard towards something on an aggressive front. But there's a difference between an aggressive approach to things and then just a completely unrealistic world where it's not going to happen. And so I think that's what you're seeing is just a lot of people are, a lot of businesses, a lot of energy infrastructure, or a lot of energy companies or something are just kind of basically trying to make it clear that, like, if we set these goals to our shareholders and we set these goals to the world and we don't achieve them, we're going to be, massively reprimanded for that, so to speak. And so I think what they're trying to do is temper expectations to some extent so that they can actually achieve their goals so that, you know, but the balance of the other side of that equation is you also can't set goals that are so weak and slow. That
2050, we hear a lot.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and, you know, 2050, I bet you, Raj, in 10 years, 2050 will be 2075 goals. So it's trying to find the balance, right, between what can we actually accomplish on an aggressive timeline versus what is unrealistic and impractical.
Yep. So let's come back to you. 11 years in quote-unquote the hot seat. I've seen you one day trying to sell horse betting, second day talking about SAF, or second conversation, should I say. What have you learned about yourself on your journey?
I'm a master of none, right?
Congratulations.
I think kind of going full circle, I've learned how to be patient. I keep using that word, but I've learned how to just kind of slow down in order to hurry up, I guess is another way to say it. I've learned the importance of the, you know, maintaining an optimistic outlook across a portfolio of companies in particular and leaders, right? It's really easy to get stuck into the trenches and quickly think that this thing isn't going to work and that business is going poorly and this sector is not going to grow like we thought. And you can easily get into that kind of internal minded negative news cycle that exists kind of everywhere now. So I've learned to take a step back, you know, like I said, with this whole 11 year anniversary, and just look at, like, okay, if you take a step back and you zoom out, like, you actually see, like, the stock market, right? You could zoom into the blips, or you could zoom out and see the inevitable rise over a long period of time. And I think it's an art form I didn't really appreciate early on in Nexus or even in my career, to be able to zoom out. But I think I'm getting better at being able to do exactly that. And then trying to figure out how to, you know, make sure that the leaders in this business, because we have lots of them now, can do the same, right? Because they are the key to this company growing. My partners are leaders within, underneath them at various respective parts of our business. And being able to see that kind of that curve trending upward, as opposed to zooming into a, you know, a downward dip in any one thing, is something that's really important, because keeping a fresh mind and keeping a positive outlook within, you know, again, within practical realistic expectations is an incredibly important thing in today's business environment.
So last question, and speaking of outlook, it's 2034, we're 10 years into the future, Fast Company, Forbes, Wall Street Journal, your favorite publication is writing a headline or a short paragraph regarding Nexus PMG. What would you like it to read?
Oh, that's a good question. Ben Hubbard retires as
retired in the past.
Retired. I want to be to see this company continue to impact, you know, the communities that we work within. There's some things that we do and that we're continuing to do that are, like, most exciting things now. And those, like, our partnership up at BioNorth with the First Nations, you know, some of the stuff we're doing in our local communities in Greenville. And just, I don't know, I just think it'd be really cool to be known, or have a headline or be known for a company that, like, actually walked the walk. There's very few companies out there that I still feel like truly stick to their morals, stick to their values, and do always try to do the right thing, even if it's not in their best interest, and all those things that, you know, get pieced together. And I think, generally speaking, that is something that we're really proud of. We really try, you know, whether it's me as an individual or even our, you know, our team as a business, you know, holistically, try to be known as the people that have integrity, that do the right thing, that tell you no when it's the right thing to say, stick up for people or, you know, partners when they deserve it, regardless of, again, whether any of this is in your best interest or not, just doing the right thing. And I think that's something that we continue to do. And I'd love to be known as the business that, like, just did it the right way, regardless of what the outcome is.
Well, Ben, I appreciate you walking the walk. I wish you all the best with Nexus, and I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Awesome. Thanks for having me again, Raj, and I'll see you in another 10 years.
Hopefully sooner.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review on iTunes. And you can show your support by sharing our show with a friend or reach out to us on social media, where you'll find us under our Nexus PMG handle. If there's a subject or topic you'd like to hear about, send me an email, btu@nexuspmg.com, or contact me via our website, nexuspmg.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter where we share what we're reading and thinking about in the clean tech, green tech sectors. Bigger Than Us is a Nexus PMG production.